divested yourself suddenly of a jacket, thank God. But now what we are required to do is to return to the passage that we've been left off. Now, I know members may be concerned, sitting on the other side, where did all these members go to? Where have they gone? Yes, we can be concerned. I'm here, you are here, and two other members have to address certain highly challenging personal issues. That is the Honourable Tierko. Passports are very serious, and laptops for the Honourable MacPherson. And both those items need their very personal attention. But they could return at any moment, either of them, or both of them, I'm hoping. All right. So I hope that you feel more assured and you don't continue trying to leave early at 3. So, because clearly we want a full day. All right, okay. Now that we have your assurance, we were going to enter into, perhaps start discussing some of the flagged issues as a start. Am I correct? I look for you for guidance. Do you remember we said we flagged certain issues? In fairness to some of the people who'd flagged issues for which they are not present, and I'm not talking about funding, I think it's important that we acknowledge that and give them the space to speak on it on their return. But having said that, let me look at the flagged issues. There was one very early on. By the way, where is the Honourable Flanguini, Mr. Herman?
Tracy, I think she had a family emergency. Her daughter was ill at school, and then she had to leave. That's what I'm
Is that what you know?
Yes.
I was not aware of that. But when it comes to family emergencies, I do not like to prevent people dealing with them. And so we come to page 7. Am I correct that that was one of the issues flagged, Mr. Herman? Page 7? No? Yes, Honourable.
There's one thing you should pass by, which was I think that it must be flagged.
I can't hear you because...
Yeah. On page 35, I don't think that was listed as flagged. That one of BB and the one not, which is in purple, I think there are a lot of things. If you can look at the double C there down, they include the disposal of luxury item to reduce the amount. Yeah, so I think that whole guidance which must be given to the minister, to the magistrate, must, the minister when making the regulations, what must happen is that we still have to look at it thoroughly. Because I think that the very purpose of this bill is to deal with the poorest of the poor. When we speak about luxury items, what are the luxury items? Is it a stove a luxury item? Is a heater a luxury item? Those are the things, because if you say it must be disposed, really to me it raises a serious red flag to what about. Because first of all, these people are earning, will not be earning more than 7,500. So when making an example of a disposable land asset, when you mention the car, is far-fetched. But what happens when whoever the magistrate comes down and say, no, but you know, we've got 4 heaters in the house, so we take 3 heaters and go and dispose them. So I think that we still have to have a thorough look at that. That's why I wanted to reflect here.
I think really the request here is that it is flagged. Am I right? I think you have a point there. And so having done that, can we then, ask you to just get to the end, because I thought you had reached the end, and we then go to the beginning, having flagged this particular issue. Are we all in agreement for flagging? Right. So we then go to page 13, as I understand it, no. That is about zero rating? Right. Mr. Hermans, do you have that flag? All right. If we're all on the same page, 13, on the zero rating, is it page 12? It starts on page 12, at the bottom, am I correct? Right. If you could reiterate what you said on that, advocate, so that we can move on with our discussion and deliberation.
Thank you, Chairperson. The page 12 is where we spoke about it, but the actual clause to consider, because page 12 is a consequential amendment, so it might be better to look at the actual clause that deals with that, because the concern is the actual fact of the magistrate's court reducing the interest, and that is on page 13, almost at the top there. It's paragraph, that's clause 12, dealing with section 86, and it's paragraph B, where we insert subparagraph CC capital A. So what we allow there is for the magistrate to determine the maximum interest, fees, or other charges on the credit agreement, which maximum may be zero, for such a period as the court deems fair and reasonable, but not exceeding the period contemplated in section 86A6D, which is 5 years or a longer period as may be prescribed. So this is where the whole issue is captured. This is where it is. The reason for including this is that what was reported to the committee, and in fact the court cases that we've looked at, in one of the cases the court actually said that even if you enter into an agreement for the interest to be reduced, the court cannot reduce the interest because there is no legislation allowing the court to do so. So the problem is that it means that your debt review system is less effective. There is a voluntary system, but that voluntary system, I think we heard about 18% of credit providers actually really participate. So there isn't really the, and the problem is, unless you bring the interest down, most of these consumers cannot repay the debt over a reasonable period of time. So that is why it is in there. There were a lot of criticism against it from the public, but one of the things that was said was that there should be guidance. So that is the other leg of it, where we say we need to provide some guidance. So that is the crux of the matter.
I may, but many of you, Honourable MacPherson, do you look happier?
Sorry, in my excitement to get back to the committee, I left my bag at the restaurant. So, yeah.
Are you happier now?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
All right. No, you're not the only one who's had a challenge. Honourable Tierko is also addressing something on her passport, but I'm glad you recovered your laptop. I'm happy to say there are very many honest people in this world, more than we know of. I've had a taxi driver waiting patiently at my car for my return for over an hour because I'd left my keys in the door. Now that was many, many years ago, lest you think it was yesterday. It was 20 years ago, and I had just come out of hospital, or more than 20, it was after that bomb blast, and I think I hadn't fully recovered to have done such a silly thing. And there it was, he waited and said, "I couldn't believe that you left your keys in your car, so I waited for you." He wouldn't take any form of remuneration except thank you. So there it is. Anyway, to get back to the issue, and I'm glad you have come back now because we're just getting into the flagged issues. I was noting that I had heard, not only on several radio stations, but read in the paper, not only about the poorest of the poor but those on a kind of low income, teachers, constables and the like, who don't realize that when they have a credit card, unless they pay back more than the minimum installment, they could be paying forever for whatever it is. So these things we need to keep in mind. Doesn't only affect the poorest of the poor, but low income earners as well. So there it is. The issue has been re-explained to us, Honourable Macpherson, just in your absence there. And we need, it was flagged, it is up for discussion. Woo, yes, Honourable Williams.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, on this point, I agree that we should, first of all, keep it. And we should, it says that CCA, the small C, big A, I think we should keep this, because fundamentally what can happen is if we don't include this, it'll be, you know, there won't be an opportunity for the magistrate to reduce the interest, to assist the poorest of the poor. So we have to actually put this in, or else it's going to, you know, it'll make the rest of the bill null and void. Thank you.
Thank you for that input. Honourable Macpherson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to reiterate my position that I stated yesterday. With the emphasis on our real determination that we should be looking to strengthen the formal credit sector, and that we should be looking at, well, what are the ways in which they generate income and to sustain the industry. Now, we know that one of the ways in which they generate income, or their primary form of income, is through interest. You'll know that there's a once-off initiation fee, that there is a service fee that's levelled every month, I think a maximum of 69 Rand. The initiation fee is a maximum of 1,000 and something, less than 1,100. So their primary return on investment or return on lending money is in fact interest. Now, if you go and threaten that very source of income for them, which is legitimately granted credit that has been granted in terms of the National Credit Act, a credit that has been granted in terms of affordability assessments, then you are undermining the very income that industry relies on to in fact continue to lend credit to the market. And by doing so, you give rise to the very industry that we all detest the most, which is the illegal credit market, machinisas, loan sharks, etc. And we will start to see the rise of that industry. So I believe that in the current regulations that exist within the Act, the current National Credit Act, that a magistrate is able to restructure the amount to be paid each month. They are able to restructure the terms in which that is paid, and they are able to, correct me if I'm wrong, CEO, but they are also able to suspend part of the agreement for some time or another. Now, the interest agreed to between a client and a provider is a contractual obligation. It's an obligation that a client agrees to. And my concern, alongside the ability of the industry to generate income and further lend credit out, would be one of contractual obligations between the credit provider and credit lender. And whether in fact that would put in jeopardy those contractual obligations and then give rise to a possible challenge within the legal system. So it's really on those two bases that certainly our position as the DA, we believe that it is a dangerous one. It will, in short, I think, make the cost of credit more expensive. It will also restrict the provision of credit to, in fact, the poorest of the poor people, who actually, if we're all frank and honest with each other, need credit to survive. And should we do that, I really do believe that we would then see a massive uptake of illegal credit in the informal credit market.
No, thank you for that, Honourable Macpherson. Just to refresh my memory on this, this was not one of the issues that Advocate Trengrove looked at?
No, he did not look at this matter.
But it was one of the issues that earlier on we had got legal opinion on in terms of constitutionality.
We have not. I have advised the Committee on Constitutionality of it because it does constitute deprivation, and the requirements for a law to deprive someone of property is that it must be a law of general application, which this bill is, and that there must be fair process, which there is. There's an application format, there's a hearing, and is there a reason? The reason that we said was that the courts indicated that they cannot reduce it unless there is legislation, even if there is an agreement to that.
Right. Now, I thought that was useful for us to get that little bit of clarity. So it can be done if there is legislation. But I hear what you are saying as well, Honourable Macpherson, but also what was said earlier. Is there any other comment? Honourable Khadeb?
Chairperson, I'd like to second the opinion of Honourable Williams that we retain this thing in place here. Because we must remember, Chair, that the total debt we're dealing with here is not more than 50,000. It's minuscule indeed. It's not more than 50,000. And then being not more than 50,000, I think that this bill actually provides for the law of general application, as the senior counsel has indicated that that's precisely what we're doing. So we can retain this thing, Chair. Let's give the magistrate the power to reduce this thing up to zero when necessary. It does not mean that it is a blanket. It sure is coming down on a cascading scale. Mm-hmm. The zero is the last, but it started at two. Can we reduce? Can this thing be done after 5 years? If it cannot be done, then it must go, because it should, that person will not be able to pay. Yeah. So let's retain this, Chair.
I have one request of you, Honourable Khadebi. You speak very quietly. And that is always welcome in Parliament because it encourages us to listen more carefully. But could you just, we've had a request that you just raise your mic sometimes. Right. Honourable Macpherson, and then followed by Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Interest is apportioned to risk. So the higher the riskier a client to a credit provider is, the higher the interest rate that they will charge. Now, I would like to understand, how is a magistrate able to determine what is an applicable interest rate on a scale between 10 and 0, as an example? How do they determine that, well, the best case for this person is to reduce their interest rate to 5 and to another person 0. Where, you know, what is the basis for them to do so? Will you not be creating a situation where I go for a debt intervention application and I'm given 0% because I found a good magistrate and he's had just come back from a great holiday and he's feeling generous? But the Honourable Kachalia has, you know, come across a magistrate who's maybe feeling a bit irritable. They had a flat tire on the way to court, and they're less inclined to give him a reduction of in interest rate. Just trying to understand, Advocate, how that scale may work and how they may eventually get to a 0% interest.
Thank you, Honourable Macpherson. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. We must remember that this bill has been put in place in order to protect the most vulnerable people in South Africa, our over-indebted poorest of the poor. Fundamentally, I don't think that the banking sector will take a huge hit if a few people are put down to zero, because remember, it's not like we're insisting that it's 0% rate. It is up to the discretion of the magistrate, which I don't think that we should have any powers to regulate the discretion of the magistrates in this particular case, because of the fact that they'll look at the information before them, and if it turns out that Adrian Williams can't afford to pay anything at all, he'll make the interest rate zero. Because remember, we're doing this in order to hopefully that person must eventually be able to be in a position where they can pay back their money. Because we're not just giving a blanket debt relief measure to everybody in the hope that, you know, they'll come right eventually. It's a plan to try and increase the capacity of people's finances and to encourage them to repay debt. And I think that we should keep this in because of who it's aimed at. It's not aimed at me. It's not my debt that's going to have 0%. Like the honourable member said previously, these are people who have a maximum of 50,000 rand debt. It's not millions of rands. It's a small amount of money. And we must give the magistrates the power to do this. Thank you.
Just to indicate to members where we are going with this, I will take the Honourable Kachalia. He hasn't spoken on the matter yet, but after that, I'm going to ask the National Credit Regulator, the CEO, Chief Executive Officer, to please just clarify and outline again for members what is currently the situation in applying the Principal Act. Is that clear? And the voluntary agreement. Are you able to do that now? So just before, allow the Honourable Kachalia to comment. Right.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to remind members that we've had considerable input from the banking sector and the lending sector and particularly from the banking sector, and they've provided us with facts and figures about the quantum of loans that they have written off. They're not insubstantial, and they amount to very large numbers that they have voluntarily written off because they understand that those people can't pay, or that they will be throwing good money after bad, running after those people to effect payment. So when it comes to the courts, understand that it has gone through that filter already. And there, the loan has been squashed, extinguished as it were, and interest has dissipated completely. Now, to then allow the courts to abrogate the right to vary interest on the basis of some subjective notion, because that's all it is, it's fundamentally, I would argue, flies in the face of good law.
Thank you, Honourable Kachalia. Sorry, Honourable Buyani.
Chair, thanks, man. I'm not so sure if we can learn something from the study tour that we made, how they were able to deal with this issue. Yeah, because this issue seemingly is very key to understand that if we can learn from that study, how they were able to deal with it at that level, so that we can have a synergy in addressing our issues here. Thanks, Jim.
No, thank you very much. That also has a bearing, and if I recall, many of you who went on the study tour are here in the committee. But let me allow the Chief Executive Officer of the National Credit Regulator just to assist us at this particular point on the current situation.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. In terms of the task team rules, these rules were arrived at by, you know, the industry together with the National Credit Regulator to assist over-indebted consumers to be able to pay back what they owe credit providers. Now, the system, the DCRS, for instance, was developed around those testing rules, and it really allows credit providers to enter into concessions where they are able to reduce, you know, interest rates of different consumers to an extent where, in some instances, consumers end up paying zero interest rates towards the loans that, you know, they owe credit providers. But at this stage, I'd like to maybe ask Mr. Mashapa to just elaborate further on this matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Mashapa?
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon to the members. The task team agreement in the DCRS was also entered into in terms of Section 48 of the National Credit Act, which requires the NCR, when they register a bank or a retailer, to also consider their commitments to combating over-indebtedness. So it's part of their conditions of registration to say to the NCR...
Is that section of the Act again?
Section 48. 48B. Subsection B. You will see that it says that when the NCR considers an application for registration, they must also look at the commitments that are made by the credit provider to combat over-indebtedness. So the credit industry, we issued a code of conduct which gave rise to the task team agreement and the DCRS. But I think what I want to draw to the attention of the committee, we don't have a personal bankruptcy law in South Africa, and it's a fact. The current insolvency law caters mainly for middle and income level people. And I think what is being proposed under this bill and also in the task team agreement, it's a process that is even entirely different from the insolvency legislation. Because under the insolvency legislation, the income and the assets that the debtor has at a particular point is what all the creditors will receive. If I owe the creditors 1 million, but my income and my assets are 100,000, that's what they will receive. Even if I've entered into agreements with them to pay them interest of 30%, the fact is if my assets are 10,000 today, they will only receive 10,000, and it will be distributed by the trustee as a dividend to each of them. What we have in this bill and the task team agreement, first of all, I think it's considerate to the industry because we're trying to protect their capital. We say you restructure the payments. If it doesn't work, suspend some agreements. If it doesn't work, then we play around with the interest rates. Only if those three options don't work, we recommend a reduction of the capital. So I think the scheme, the way it's outlined, you can see that its primary objective is to protect the capital. And if you look at the insolvency legislation, many creditors lose their capital outlays.
I think many countries internationally have moved away from what operated in the Dickensian era to a greater or lesser degree. And that is what's important. I also think, yes, the study tour does help in this regard, in the sense that they, in some instances, are able to do far more than we are doing, in primarily because they are working from their treasury or exchequer or the national finance, as it were. And they're able to do that. But even there, what prevails is different approaches in the three, what do they say, it's England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, you know, the different groupings of one country, if I may put it that way. One. Now, I wouldn't call them homelands, Mr. Hermans, at all. So I don't know what we're getting into now at this point. No, and I don't think the United Kingdom, and we're going there to say farewell to the Consul General, would appreciate that. So, but the point being made is that in Wales, where indeed they have great distress, it is far more lenient, far more than even this Act. In the United Kingdom, it has that, what is often seen as that very British approach to ensure that the Bank of England survives. Then in the Scottish approach, once again a more measured. But Honourable Bouyani, you wish to add something on that, did you? Otherwise I can ask who was on that, which it was the researcher was with us, was she? In London.
The content
advisor managed to leave her little son. Right. So do comment before Miss Sheldon.
No, in the absence of the report, Chair, I still believe that the explanation by the NCR can prevail, Chair. Thanks.
Sheldon? Do you want to add anything? You were on that study visit.
Just that the UK model that we looked at, where they're actually extinguishing debt. They're not even, they're just writing it off. So all the capital, all of that would be gone. I think there is maybe a slight confusion in that this particular subsection we're looking at would also affect debt review and the debt intervention process. I think the intention is to enable this cross-team agreement and actually be able to implement it, because in certain cases where it goes to the magistrate's court, it's where there's not consensus among all credit providers.
Yeah.
So even the ones who did agree that they want that, fine, you may lower the interest rate so that the person can solve, could also be overridden, is my understanding. So in that instance, the consumer would not then be able to solve at all if you would go revert back to the old interest rate.
Yes, I think, and I will allow you to come in after me, Honourable MacPherson. That is the whole point. We thought that the principle of sufficient consensus would have prevailed, not necessarily with the magistrate's law. And we were advised, some of you recall, I think we were in V474 or something, that indeed we needed to put this in our legislation per se, so that it could be processed by the magistrates. But let us have your comments, Honourable MacPherson.
I just want to pose a question, because the Honourable Williams says that that this is aimed at the poorest of the poor. Now, if you want to affect the poorest of the poor, make their access to credit more expensive and more restrictive. That's actually what's going to affect the poorest of the poor and people who want to get access to credit. And again, I repeat that if you start to undermine the ability of the formal regulated market to generate an income and thereby extend credit continuously, I think that you're going to run into a problem long term. Now, I also just want to make the point that I think, when it comes to, debt extinguishment, I mean, there are very clear cases and examples to do that, and that will be done in terms of the debt intervention process. What concerns me is where is this zero rate interest going to be extended to? And once you create a category for that, in this particular market, it then becomes very easy to start over time legislating to extend that into other parts of the credit pipeline, if you will, or the credit market. And that's what troubles me. So what I've always said, and what I had always hoped that the intention of this bill would be, was to make debt intervention or debt counselling more affordable to lower income groups, to, as I've said previously, keep them in the credit market, assist them to come out of debt, and to keep them healthy. I'm just really concerned that this is another sort of roadblock into them doing so, and in them being able to access credit in an affordable manner going forward. I mean, let's also not forget that there are also caps on interest rates. There are affordability assessments that determine, you know, what people can actually access. And again, I ask the question, advocate, how does a magistrate determine what percentage is applicable to an applicant? Why would I get 5% and the Honourable Kachalia get 2% or 0% eventually? Do they say today you've got 5% and in 6 months' time you lodge another application to have it reduced to 0%? How does that process work?
If earlier on it was explained, but you may just have been out in fairness. And that's the very reason for the framework of guidelines that is within this new the bill. So that is to cover that unfortunate occurrence. Honourable Williams, I do see your hand, but the Honourable Mantush had her hand up first. Let me recognise her, followed by yourself.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, the study tour that we undertook, Chair, there has been no evidence that introducing debt relief had made loans to be expensive. There has been no evidence that we had collected, so I don't want us to every time go back there, because there's no evidence to that effect, and that has not changed the behaviour of debtors.
May I add, before members come in, if you looked at the comparative studies given to us last year, that was also the case in other countries which we could not visit, Croatia and India among two. Honourable Williams, followed by the Honourable Hadebe.
Thanks, Chair. We've just heard from the National Credit Regulator that the insolvency legislation that fundamentally protects rich people when they can't afford to pay back their debt isn't applicable to poorest of the poor. And so for the Honourable Honourable MacPherson to say that this is now going to be this big thing and, you know, it's going to shoot the price of credit through the ceiling and the poor are not going to have access to credit anymore because of the sudden huge thing that we're doing. We must remember that every day rich people go insolvent in South Africa and stop paying their debt. How come debt hasn't been, credit hasn't been pushed up as so expensive because of that? So I think that if we can assist the poorest to have the same protection that rich people have when they run into problems, and in particular we use this to give the magistrate the opportunity to reduce their interest down to zero so that they have the same protection as rich people, because fundamentally it's all about fairness. We can't say, well, you're poor, sorry for you. You know, we've got to actually start defending the poor as well, and if we're going to defend the rich, then we must defend the poor with as much vigor. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable Hadebe.
No, Chairperson, Honorable Williams has gone straight to what I was going to say. If you can go back to the advice of the senior counsel, he said in 31.2, the procedure for death is long, thorough, and perhaps even unduly arduous. Here we're having a situation of someone who's poor, when the process of dealing with his issue of indebtedness, we're going to start first with the issue of the interest. Must go down first, let's say if it was 12, let's go to 8. Why not go straight to the issue of the extinguishment, because this person is already over indebted, as the Insolvency Act is doing to the rich people. So I think that here, Chair, will never agree with Mr. McPherson. Actually, I think that the protection is high time that it goes to the poorest of the poor. Because from the constituencies we are coming from, we see poverty every day. We know what we are speaking about. We know of the marriages which are breaking down. We know of the people who are now have become alcoholics because they are in debt. That's what we see every day. Yeah, some commit suicide. That's what we see. So now we are going to spend a lot of time, in stopping the process which is going to help them. I think it's unfair. We are not going to agree on that one. I think that we must just say that we are not going to agree with Mr. McPherson. It's high time we protect the poorest of the poor. But I think when we deal with it, clause by clause, some of the things which they were going to concede, we might even reconsider not doing that.
Now what I'm going to do, with the flag, I've given all opportunities to all members to reflect their positions, and it's clear to me as chair that no consensus will be reached. Therefore, we will leave it until we do get to the process of clause by clause. We are now moving on to the next flag. And I believe that is on page 16.
In a sense, it is, because it talks to the increase, but the actual correct clause itself is in two places. The first clause is the actual definitions clause. So, if I can refer members to page four, it is paragraph A at the top. And the insertion of the definition of debt intervention applicant. And if we look there at paragraph B under that definition, it talks about receives no income. And then as you read a little bit further, on average for 6 months preceding the date of the application for debt intervention did not exceed 7,500 or such an amount as may be prescribed by section 171 per month. Then this is the first leg, so in other words, the increase of the income. The second leg is on, I'll just go to the page. Is on page 13, it is clause 13, and it is section 86, capital A, subsection 1. And there we talk about if that debt intervention applicant has a total unsecured debt owing to, page 13, it is clause 13, and it's a section 86, capital A, subsection 1. So a debt intervention applicant may apply, and then a little bit on, if that debt intervention applicant has a total unsecured debt owing to credit providers of no more than 50,000, or such an amount as may be prescribed by section 171. So that is the second leg. And then we must read that together with the actual clause 29, which amends section 171, which is on page 35. I lied, it starts on page 35, but it goes a little bit further. It is on page 37 at the bottom there, where it says the minister may by notice and after having considered the following factors adjust.
Has everyone got that page then?
Page
37. It starts on page 35 but it continues on to page 37.
So on page 37 then, we have paragraph A, which deals with the income. So we say the minister may, by notice in the Gazette, adjust the amount in respect of the maximum gross income. And what must he keep in mind? What must he consider? The one factor is the gross income required by a consumer to be an economically viable client for a debt counsellor as at the time of the proposed adjustment, as well as the cost associated with an administration and sequestration order as at the time of the proposed adjustment, and thirdly, inflation. So that those are the three things that the minister must consider before he adjusts income. Inflation, what it would cost to actually do administration or sequestration order, and what would make you economically viable for a debt counsellor. And then paragraph B says that the minister may adjust the amount for the qualifying total unsecured debt if he after he's considered the effect inflation might have had on that amount. Then in paragraph C we say before the minister may make this adjustment, he must table that adjusted figure in the National Assembly. He must give a rationale for that adjustment. In other words, what is the reason? What did you take into account and how did you come to this figure? And then the Assembly must actually approve that adjusted figure. And once it's approved by the Assembly, then he can make that adjustment by notice in the Gazette. So that is what the things that you need to read together. And then, of course, the paragraph D there says, regardless of this adjustment, you cannot make that in respect of a person whose debt is going to be suspended or extinguished. So all of those need to be read together.
I think, honourable members, yes, I did see the hand. It certainly does address this issue of the minister simply making decisions on his own, but needing to come to the National Assembly. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think that with regard to this section, I'm going to call it a section, but it's specifically about what is going to happen in years' time when the inflation goes up. We need to adjust these figures because in 10 years' time, 7,500 rand a month, you know, nobody, it'll be so little. We can't have that. So we could, over time, we can't allow ourselves to slowly remove the poorest of the poor because, you know, so I think we should accept this as it is. It's just to deal with, you know, inflation and things of this nature. So I think we should accept it in this particular case because the minister will take it to the House. The House will discuss it. So if the House discusses it, you know, we'll be involved in that decision. We could reject that, in fact. Thank you.
No, indeed. We did put in your apology, Honourable Tiako. All right? Thank you. Honourable, I just want Honourable Tiako to take her seat. So, of course, she doesn't talk in front of you, walk in front of you. Honourable McPherson.
Thanks, Chair. What I would like to see in this is a safeguard in terms of when the minister may do this, how many times per year or in a parliament that he may be able to determine this. Because he could bring this as many times, or he or she, could be you, could bring this, you know, as many times as they wanted in a parliamentary year. So I just can't remember if there is a time from when the bill when the bill is enacted to when this may first appear. I know that he has to produce that report within 36 months after the bill, but he could do this within month one after the bill is enacted. So I think that there should be a minimum time before they can introduce this, and I think that it should only be able to be introduced every 12 months for review, or every 2 years, or two or three times within a parliament.
Yes, I just want to clarify for myself, actually. You see, when I looked at this, it was referring to a single applicant. And with respect to a single applicant, how many times would he come, the minister or she come? So perhaps you could just clarify that.
This point deals with the minister gazetting an adjustment of the amounts considered in section 1 with respect to the gross income of a debt applicant. So my argument would be that there should be a time period between when the bill is enacted and when the first review may take place, and subsequent to that, that may only take place X number of times in a parliament.
No, thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Williams.
Jefferson, thank you. I do think that perhaps in this particular case, the Honourable MacPherson might be correct. And I think that we should have this review annually. We should say the minister should annually look at the figures, whether or not they are in line, and if not, bring a recommendation to Parliament. And we should just say annually. And then that will stop it happening repeatedly. And I think most of the time, well, I don't think it will happen, but I think we should put it in annually. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I just want to get this clear, Honourable Williams. You're saying that the review should take place annually, but would the minister need to return to the National Assembly whether or not it's clarified?
Chairperson, I think that we should put in that if there is a change, the minister must come to the National Assembly. But for instance, the minister's office could look at the figures in his office and decide that there is no need for a change, but he must have a look at it annually. But if there is a need for a change to make that 7,500 more, then he has to come to Parliament and justify that number.
Yes, but Honourable Williams, how would we know? How would we know the minister's team has reviewed it, you see? Without a report. Do you follow what I'm saying? Yes. So I'm just saying it's one thing for us to say review, 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 but how would we know? Right. Honourable Kadebi, I just want this point, and I have seen your hand, Honourable MacPherson.
Chairperson, once there is a review, it means that a report must be issued. That's
absolutely. Honourable MacPherson?
Chair, I think sometimes, I believe that more clarity is better than less. So I don't necessarily agree with an annual review. But what I do want to suggest is that I think that there should be a time period stipulated between when the bill is enacted and between when that first review is taking place. I think that there should be definitions like not more than CPI. I think that an inclusion around what the maximum the minister may be able to increase that by, because that brings further definition. And I'm not going to put on the table yet what I think that or how often it should take place, because I actually just want to do some research, and I want to ask some questions on that particular point. But I do think that there should be a time after the bill is enacted, sort of, you can't do it within the first 30 days sort of thing, that it is within a maximum of CPI, and that it takes place X number of times within a parliamentary calendar.
Your points are noted, so that we can move on. As I see it, then there isn't really a consensus, because the one position is saying annual review, taking into account inflation. Would inflation not, and it's really, I pose this rhetorically, not for a response, and that is, would inflation not have to take into account CPI, or vice versa? My own study of economics, but it may be a little outdated in the last 5 years, it may be at risk. So let us move, and then where is the next flag? All right, the next issue, I understand from Ms. Sheldon, who's also keeping all these notes, is under regulations. Is that correct? Are we all on the same page here? And you know, there's nothing that taxes one's mind as much as dealing with legislation of this nature. It is, you know, as serious as undertaking examinations. So really it is quite taxing and strenuous. So here we go on this issue, and I got, at one point I was advised by the staff that the DTI wanted to comment, but they may have been the advocate who wanted to come in. Is that right?
Chair, on which area, which point?
It was towards the end when we were going on and on, but we may have passed that occasion. So now we'll deal with the regulations. Is that in order? Right. Are we all, Honourable McPherson?
Well, exactly. We're at a point, and I was
going to suggest that the advocate just gave us a little outline so that we were all on the same page and then engaged. Are we in agreement? You can see there is a need for that. All right? There is a real need for that. Advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, Jean. I think the next main issue is the issue of the minister being able to prescribe a debt intervention measure. So that starts on page 35. It is 2 capital A. And what we have is a significant exogenous shock, the national disaster, who it may benefit, and then the process. And a little bit even further down the definition for significant exogenous shock and natural disaster. Now, as I've indicated yesterday, from our opinions that we've received, Advocate Trenkov is of the opinion that this is delegation of plenary powers. But when we crafted this portion here, we considered the opinions of Senior Counsel Malindi and Gilbert Marcus. And both of those opinions indicated that if you simply focus on the significant exogenous shock and the natural disaster, they're of the view that it may pass constitutional muster. I am personally of the view that it is an implementation concern and not an actual delegation of plenary powers. But that having been said, what we have here is the two circumstances that we have, the significant exogenous shock and the natural disaster, are both such broad terms that it's very difficult to define them. They mean what they mean. Their dictionary meaning is what they mean. And unless we actually want to limit them, they will stay broad. And the problem is with limiting these terms that you then take away their effectiveness. Because the moment you limit them, there could be things that we can't foresee happening, and then it falls outside of that limit. So that is the first problem, is the terms are broad, and there's not really something that you can do about it. The definitions that we attempted, I'm not sure that they're really successful. They simply say what the thing is, and it doesn't really give a limit. The other big problem is that this prescribed regulation that can be done by the minister, if we retain it, we need to look at who it will benefit. We need to just tighten that. And if we bring that down to the 7,500 limit, and if we say that the minister can only prescribe what is currently in the Act, which is the other thing that we'll need to limit, because that is what, in my view, would make it implementation and not the actual delegation of plenary powers. If we do that limit, then it becomes something that is unnecessary because we already have it in our existing measure. It's already there. If you earn less than 7,500, regardless if that was as a result of a retrenchment, if that was as a result of bad business decisions, if that was as a result of a significant exogenous shock, if that was as a result of the natural disaster, you would qualify. So there would not be a need for the minister to do these regulations. And because of that, my recommendation is that we take this out. It is something that is not necessary in the bill.
Look, there were two hands up. Now, I'm not sure if you had your hand up before Honourable McPherson, but I see Honourable Williams. Honourable Williams. No, that's very good of you. Thank you. Honourable Williams, followed by the Honourable McPherson.
Thank you, Chair. Removing this is the easy way. I want to know what happens to the people who are poor, that experience this mass retrenchment, the shocks, is there nothing that we can put in instantaneously that would assist them? For instance, what happened to the poor people in Knysna when the houses burned? What happened to their debt? I mean, a lot of that debt was rich people's debt, so they might have had house insurance or insurance, etc. But what about the poor people who did nothing happen to them? Did they just become poorer and that was that? So the reason why this was put in the first place was so that we could accommodate the poorest of the poor if there was an act of God or whatever it is, massive, and that affected a lot of people over, a short period. So that's why that's here. But I do understand the advocate's point, saying if it does happen, they can all just apply for debt relief. But I wanted, I'm still of the opinion that there should be some mechanism to protect people in that circumstance. But I do think that perhaps to move forward together, we should remove this clause. Thank you.
I do hear what you are saying, the Honourable Williams. No, the whole issue of fires is very, very serious. We've seen Europe going up in flames. When I was in London, they even closed half of the German airports in Germany because the runways, the tar was melting as aircraft took off. I mean, this is not a joke any longer. And Greece. We all saw that. America, the United States. And in our own country, we did see exactly the situation referred to by the Honourable Williams. Honourable MacPherson.
Thanks, Chair. I just want to, Advocate, get into the regulations with respect to the guidance to the Magistrates Court. I'm curious by the inclusion of the liquidation of luxury items. Are we not on page 35?
Right. I do see it. In actual fact, the reference has been made to what the advocate, as I understand, shortly before lunch, indicated could be in guidelines for the magistrate. Is that correct? So it is an order for the comment to take place.
I'm curious around the inclusion of luxury items. And I just want to know what is the rationale behind that. I would think that if I had written it, it would have included the disposal or liquidation or whatever of realizable assets or goods, because a luxury item is, quite frankly, could be subjective. What I consider to be a luxury item, you may already own. And so I would have thought that there would have been a focusing on goods and assets to liquidate or dispose of. Then with respect to EE, the idea for the magistrate to consider the impact of the reduction of charges on any credit life insurance applicable to a credit agreement before it. I'm quite worried about that because that is a contractual obligation that exists between the credit provider and a credit taker to protect the value of that credit amount. Now, and that's a separate insurance product that exists within the total payment to the credit provider every month. And if that payment is not made, then the insurance would become null and void, which means that in fact the credit taker would have no cover. So I'm not sure that you can actually go and reduce the amounts payable of credit life insurance. But I stand to be corrected. I'm not sure how you actually do that. With respect to the prescribing of debt interventions, I think it's been certainly our position, myself and my colleague, Honourable Kachalia, that that if there is a disaster of some sort or another, the committee is well within its rights to develop a bill. We've heard that that can be done in a very short space of time. I think there was even an example of a bill being developed and passed by the House within 4 days. But also what I want to say is that, in fact, protection exists for people that lose their jobs, that have credit agreements. Now, what I do think we should be doing is when an employer retrenches employees, that assistance is provided to them to actually go through their credit agreements and understand where they can actually activate those policies. Now, I believe, you know, strongly that is the responsibility that employers should take. So you will find that, in fact, you know, when all the miners were retrenched in Rustenburg, that if those credit agreements were done with a registered credit provider, with the NCR, that more likely than not, a credit insurance product would have existed on that amount, and that they should have actually activated it. Now, I'm not saying it's correct that the credit providers themselves did not say, well, actually, you are covered in this period, but I think that there needs to be a responsibility on both the credit provider and the employer that is doing the retrenchments to offer advice on what credit agreements exist with the consumer to be able to activate them until they are able to find employment.
No, thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Williams, followed by the Honourable Khadebe.
Sorry, Chair, I was just a bit confused because we've got two page 35s. You know, the original one and then the one that was... So we're both talking on different items. But with regard to Honourable MacPherson's suggestion that the employer must now must do something with, I support that. I think that's very good. The problem is that if we don't make it compulsory, the employer doesn't have to do it and might not do it. So that could be a problem. We need something that compels the protection of retrenched or vulnerable people. Thank you.
Now, what I would like to do is to separate this. Let me first hear the Honourable Khadebe.
Chairperson, when I raised this issue of page 35, the loose page, that it must be flagged, it was precisely on the issue of the luxury items. Because what do we mean by that? Because to one person, a luxury item might be a car, but to another person can be a heater. So a heater which warms the house.
Yeah.
You know, can a magistrate give an order that heater must be sold? Whatever it might be. So that's why I think that we have to apply our minds thoroughly around that. And then agree with what the Honourable Williams said before, that the issue of, for the sake of going forward, that if it's an act of God, which has happened, but I think that must take God out of this and put the devil in. Because God can never harm his people. It's only the devil who can bring the fires and the floods. Thank you.
Which is probably why a number of Christian churches are reviewing the Lord's Prayer about the Lord leading us into temptation. Was that really the correct interpretation? We've got to have open minds on these issues. It won't be the first time someone from above, in this case referred to as God, has suddenly found himself many negative issues being attributed to him or her. So let us rather leave this out. I know it's perhaps most unfortunate that insurances often refer to it as that, regrettably, and not necessarily that they are believing in anything, but nevertheless referring. So what I want to do at this point, though, is to separate this, because this was a proposal in lieu of this, but it didn't have any mention of national disasters, etc. So I need a clear position now from committee members to see whether there is some consensus that we remove what was on the original page 35 here. And I'm also watching the time. I think the meeting was scheduled to conclude at, if I may add, 6 o'clock this evening. However, it is not our intention to drag things out at all. And you are working very efficiently and effectively. So, going back to the original page 35, the Honourable Williams made a passionate plea for the consideration of the most vulnerable and the poor, and the fact that so far they don't seem to benefit, you know, under existing legislation from some immediate relief, a write-off, as it were. And for us to look at that, we referred to the fires in the Eastern Cape as one issue. So I'd like us to once and for all address this original page 35. I'd like you to say the last word, Honourable Williams, on the matter. Honourable MacPherson.
Thanks, Chair. I really think that, I think that there seems to be broad consensus to do away with the prescribed measures by the Minister. However, advocates, I do think that there is an opportunity to compel employers in the case of exogenous shocks resulting in mass retrenchments, that there must be a responsibility on them to help employees understand the credit agreements that exist and whether in fact they can access insurance products that they are paying for. I don't believe that that's an unreasonable request, and I think that that would go some way to mitigate the concerns that the Honourable Williams may espouse on this issue.
Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Williams,
talking
of the original page 35.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, the situation that could occur where vulnerable people would be left basically alone and more vulnerable in the event of a natural disaster or massive retrenchment could be dealt with, as Honourable MacPherson said, in a committee. If we can get a bill, an emergency bill, through the House in 4 days, I think it would be even quicker than the Minister doing anything, to be honest. And I think that we should go with that. On the measure to compel the employer to give, I don't know, financial training or not training, but look into those policies of the employee, I think that that's a very good idea, but I don't think we should add it to this bill because it will just slow us down. We'll have to call public hearings because it's affecting the employer and labour. It's a labour bill. We should perhaps go through the Labour Committee to look at that, but I think that we should take it on board. But with regard to the clause that has been recommended to be removed from this bill, I would propose that we accept that recommendation. Thank you.
Right, now, I am once and for all separating these two. The original page 35 here, we have consensus that it is, in fact, removed, deleted. And we then refer and look at the new page 35, which is in three colours, black, red and purple. And we've had two proposal, one proposal, as it were, with several supporters, the one about the employers. Now, it may be that the entirety of that proposal need not be thrown out. In its entirety, as expressed by yourself, Honourable MacPherson, it does not fall under our mandate, in its entirety. However, there may be aspects of it that one could look at and just check with the advocate whether it's possible to retain any aspect of that. Let us do that first before we move on. Advocate van der Merwe,
Thank you, Chief. Yes, in fact, when I presented on the purple, I indicated that I think it needs a little bit of work done. I did it this morning. And where I found this was from the submissions made by people on our second call for comments. So I used the wording proposed by these persons, by the submitters. So yes, I agree. For instance, DTI has already indicated, should we not rather have disposal than the word liquidation? Luxury items came up. The proposal was made in respect of realizable assets. We've already looked at that in terms of the Magistrates Court Act, so there is something that we can touch on there. And I know that Justice indicated to us that they know that the Magistrates Court Act hasn't been reviewed in a long time, and they are working on that to up that kind of value. So it's definitely something to re-look at. It's something to reword, perhaps. Even your existing voluntary agreement, should we not rather refer to, I don't know the full name, but the DCRS, should we not rather have that? You know, isn't it a more well-known term? Things like that. But what we need, because this is something that is inserted because of inputs from the public. So it is not something that the committee has actually made a specific decision on. So the decision that we need is, first off, and I know that decision hasn't been taken, but if we accept for argument's sake and just for the consideration of this clause, if we accept that the power of the magistrate to reduce interest and charges, if that is retained in the bill, then are we going to allow the minister to prescribe regulations? And if we allow the minister to prescribe regulations, are we going to simply say to the minister, you may prescribe guidelines? Or are we going to say to the minister, you must prescribe guidelines for the magistrates' courts, but we want this to be in there? And I would really recommend that we do provide some guidance to the minister if we do go for this clause to say that there must be some guidance. And also listening to the conversation in the committee, it sounds to me like there might be a need for the minister to do something that guides magistrates' courts, so that you don't have something where one magistrate court does X and the other one does Y. The Act itself has a form of limitation on that. If we look at Section 86 of the Act itself, this court order that we're dealing with here, this guidance to the magistrates' court when they reduce the interest rate, is not just something that will come about without any substance, without any history. It will only come about if the consumer is over-indebted. Then the debt counsellor must issue a proposal recommending to the magistrate court what must be done. So in other words, the magistrate court will be sitting with a proposal that went through the debt review process already. So the decision on reducing interest rates and etc. will not be a random thing that is a random decision that is made, or a thumbsuck, so to speak. It will be something that fits in with the system that is currently in existence. And that is in what the magistrate will base their decision on. So yes, the Act does provide guidance already. So the decision could be, no, we think the Act provides sufficient guidance because already the debt counsellor would have gone through the debt review process and there'll be a proposal before the magistrate. But if we do, and this is why I've put it in, DTI indicated that they would like to give guidance to the magistrate. Now, if that is the case, the Act does not allow them to do it formally. It will not have the status of legislation unless we insert this clause about the regulations. So that is, in other words, the first decision to be made. Do we want to make that guidance formal? And if so, we need to add a regulation clause to the Act. Then the second question is, if we want to make it formal and we've inserted this regulation clause, do we give the minister a free hand on
let's
guidance?
Just separate it. The first issue, are we all on board here, is that we have already thrown out the original. We say we're going with guidelines from the minister. If that is indeed the case, this framework of guidelines, we need to incorporate it within the primary legislation. and not secondary. Is that correct? And Honourable Macpherson, we need everyone on board, and I do need, you know, a way forward. Honourable Khadebe?
Chairperson, the issue of providing the magistrates with a guideline is very important. I think that we must take it on board, because we know very well that there are a lot of cases where in the court it was said that, you know, the law is silent around this issue. So I think that we must push it for that, Chair. Thank you.
I think what the Honourable Khadebe has said is very clearly expressed. Honourable Macpherson?
Yeah, just I just want to just try and get just some response on EE. My concerns I'd raised there with a magistrate being able to reduce the charges on credit life insurance.
Can I also ask for clarification from the advocate here? We have just made it clear that in our country at the moment, as I understand, not everyone can be sequestered per se, not those earning this, not this target group. Under sequestration, then, can this be addressed? Because if you know, or bankruptcy. So if it's bankruptcy, is it all written off? I don't know. If you could just first give us this clarity and then respond to the Honourable Macpherson's question.
Thank you, Chairperson. And just speaking of Honourable Macpherson's question, it's actually the opposite. The reason for the inclusion was so that credit life insurance would not be reduced. So yes, the wording probably needs a little bit of work. And as I said this morning, I drafted it this morning because I felt a little bit uncomfortable about not giving guidance to the minister. So broadly, I looked at what the submitters gave. I used those. And then one of the ones that they said was, how would it affect credit life insurance? Because if you reduce the charges on credit life insurance, it lapses. So that is, in fact, the reason for that to be in there. But I suppose the wording needs to be changed so that we make it very clear that if there is credit life insurance, that charges aren't reduced. So it's just about working with the wording. Then, Mrs. Fuff, the issue of sequestration, this reduction of interest rates and charges actually do not come into play at all, because regardless of the interest rate, whatever is available to be distributed amongst the creditors is what is distributed. So, on for instance, if there is a mortgage bond, and the house is sold at auction for 10,000 rand, regardless of whether that there's still 100,000 that could have been claimed on interest for the next 10 years, that will be that 10,000 rand that is divided. So the reduction of interest and charges don't come up simply because they actually stop at the time where the whole account is liquidated.
No, fine. Thank you very much. I see now that the EE is actually, and I saw the Honourable Williams with his hand up, was to require the magistrate to consider the impact of a reduction. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think that it's hard enough to look at this legislation when the wording is correct. I think that we should have an opportunity to the advocate should bring us stuff that is correct, because this is confusing us when it's like this, and now we spend 10 minutes on something that actually we shouldn't have even talked about because it's irrelevant. So, I mean, it's nice that we've got this blue-purple thing, this clause here, but I do think that maybe from today onwards, anything that comes before us must be what we finally, you know, submitting, sort of. Not that there's, you know, what I'm saying. We can't have ambiguous clauses that we don't even understand, and we're discussing, and it's wrong. Thank you.
Well, it isn't wrong, you know, one must correct it. You're absolutely telling this magistrate, look here, don't just take this position lightly. Consider the impact. So it's not wrong, but it may be a little too cautious. So you would like it clear cut. Right. Honourable Williams?
Yeah, but I'm not particularly talking about this particular... I'm just saying that when we get documents in front of us talking about legislation, in particular talking about clauses in legislation, those clauses must read exactly what... They mustn't be like, I've just quickly typed it in this morning and presented it to the House this afternoon. We need to get the actual, you know, the actual real clause. Because now these clauses have to be changed a little bit. Because the advocate admitted to this House that the language could be changed. So I'd like to see clauses where the language doesn't have to be changed. Because we sit here and we discuss it. I can carry on talking about this until 6 o'clock tonight, Jefferson.
I can hear that, but you know, this is not a court. And therefore, I do not like phrases such as admitted. Because then I suddenly put myself in the position of a, you know, an official of the justice system, and I'm not. I don't want any admissions here. No one's paying fines. No. So I think the thing is, you know, in fairness, Honourable Williams, and I must say this, we had said as a committee, we know that the advocate has to bring something back to us. And basically, it is what I called a framework draft. Because actually, it is not her bill. It is our bill, and every member here is required to draft as such. And it may be, and for me, it is an interesting recollection. More than 20 years ago, we did exactly that. We drafted our bills ourselves. It did take a lot longer. Now we are allowed to ask a legal person to do a framework draft for us. And it does go faster. But I also take your point very seriously that, in all fairness, we have spent a lot of time on something that perhaps we did not need to spend so much time. Am I right? Yes. So I do think that you have made the point there, which will be taken on board. So perhaps the advice, Honourable or Advocate van der Merwe, is that you would put two little phrases there, two little clause E's, to one making it clear, and the other one would say require the magistrate not to reduce, and another one this way, and then we choose between the two, and in that respect it would make it faster. But I know, yes, there was a lot of pressure, but Honourable MacPherson, you have returned, and the Honourable Williams also agrees now that we're all much clearer about what this meant, including myself. We all agree we don't want this to be reduced. No. In fact, we want to make it clear that it is not. Isn't that the intention, Advocate? Right. And that is the clause we are adopting, that phraseology. Now, where are we at this point? I think that's the end, is it not?
Oh, no.
Was one other item raised by members, and that was the disposal of luxury items, which you then proposed we go to the magistrate's legislation, and there it looks at realizable assets. Well, you do know a bed is a realizable asset, and I do not think that should be disposed of. A bed is a very realizable asset. Yes, a fridge, a stove. So I think that we're on dangerous ground and we need a bit more chat. Yes, Honourable Williams.
Jefferson, with regard to these assets that we're going to take from away from the poorest to the poorest so they can pay back their massive over-indebtedness, we did discuss this quite a lot in the subcommittee, because we didn't want to define, because everybody says what's one person's luxury is another person's, you know, rubbish, you know, it couldn't happen that way. And so we didn't want to define it, bearing in mind the group of people that this bill is aimed at. This bill is not aimed at people that fundamentally have luxuries. We know for a fact, if you're earning less than 7,500 rand a month in your household, I can guarantee you that luxuries is something you've inherited. Or, you know, it's very, and that's why we removed it. So we didn't even want, we don't think that an old 10-year-old fridge should be sold, and then those people are sitting with no fridge. In fact, we shouldn't define what luxuries are at all, because what we can fundamentally be doing is making poor people even more poor. So I think we should not have any different definition here. I don't think that we should use it. We must be making this bill to protect the poor, not to protect the financial service providers. Thank you.
Honourable MacPherson, did I see another hand here besides Honourable MacPherson? Honourable Hadebe.
Thanks, Chair. I disagree with the Honourable Williams, and I'll use a couple of examples why. If someone has gone and bought a fridge on credit, and they apply for debt intervention, they effectively will get that fridge for free. If they have bought a bed from, you know, whatever the bed store is, and they bought that on credit, and they then apply for debt intervention, and the, you know, that they are not able to, that there's no requirement for them to sell that in an attempt to repay the debt, they will get that for free. And so you very quickly can create a culture of people going to buy assets or, you know, goods with unsecured credit products that may very well acquire those products completely for free should they receive debt intervention. And I think that that is the moral hazard that exists in having no ability to recoup that through the disposal of goods or assets. So I just want to flag that, because I think that that is problematic, and I don't think that we should encourage something like that. I would just...
Point is made. I saw two hands, the Honourable Hadebe, the Honourable Mantash.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think that we have resolved this issue. The advocate has said that she has dealt with this thing in the morning. She'll go back and deal with it thoroughly. Let's give her that chance. But as she goes to deal with that, she must take those issues of luxury items. The luxury items issues and the issue of taking existing industry standards and practices. Usually when you deal with the existing industry standards and practices, selling the goods of the people. That's what happens. What usually happens. So that's why that the issue of who we are dealing with here must be taken into account. But let's give her a chance to couch something which can protect these people and then actually take these people forward. Thank you.
Honourable Mantash.
Chairperson, I'm covered with what Honourable Khadeb is saying, but just want to highlight that really one man's meat can be one man's poison, another man's poison. Because maybe Honourable MacPherson is still holding that view that a black person doesn't deserve to have a fridge. Because it is not only the things that you owe that are repossessed when we are highly indebted. They can take a fridge that we had already paid for. So black people deserve to have beds, they deserve to have refrigerators, they deserve to have heaters so that they can live. Thank you, Chair.
I just want to remind you about the what was referred to as the TTA. I think, what is it called? The Task Team Agreement. Just take me back there, because there is a reference to that. And in that Task Team Agreement, it which is referred to by the many stakeholders who came, who made representations and addressed the committee, it says luxurious items are those items that the consumer does not need and which the average consumer applying for debt counselling should not have. Now, there is already something within the TTA which has been referred to. And I see the professor is holding up this document very proudly, which I assume you wish to talk to, yes. And then we'll come back. Yes, Professor Maseko.
Thanks, Chair. It wasn't proudly, it was frantically. Chair, I wanted to assist the committee in the issue of what can be attached when a person is being sued and all that. I think the committee does not need to battle with this because it's already in the Sheriff's Act. For instance, clothes of children, school books and things like that are already, beds, blankets, etc., cannot be taken. So it's already covered. I think if you can even be silent on it, then the sheriff will know not to touch certain things because they already do that on a daily basis.
So there we are already assisted in that regard. So we don't have to crack our skulls on it. All right? Oh, you want to crack your skull, Honourable Macpherson?
I just think once again that, you know, it's disappointing that, you know, sort of racial epithets are thrown around that.
What are you referring to? Cracking off skulls?
I'm just referring to, you know, I just think it's disappointing that when members put suggestions on the table, that there's this view that if you are of one race, you cannot understand another race. And I think that that's unfortunate.
And what you're talking about.
Well, the Honourable Mantash said that I wouldn't understand, you know, what black people are trying to do or not do. And that's just unfortunate, Chair, because what we're trying to do here is develop a bill that doesn't encourage the moral hazard. And I think that whether you are white or Indian or black is completely inconsequential to that debate. And I would just ask, Chair, that in future that you try and guide the committee away from sort of, you know, racial labelling, because I just don't think it helps anyone, to be perfectly honest.
I didn't hear the reference to black. I am very honest. I will certainly check on any Hansard. What I did hear was the reference, as I understood it, rightly or wrongly, was I wouldn't understand what it means, neither would you or most people sitting in this room have that full understanding and appreciation. But your point is taken. I have not known the Honourable Mantash to be racist in any way. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I won't refer to anybody as race, but I will refer to the bourgeois. okay, sorry. The Honourable Macpherson keeps referring to this moral hazard, and we know from our overseas trip that we asked about moral hazard repeatedly. So the moral hazard has not been established yet, and it is just a guess. I don't believe that there will be a moral hazard whatsoever. I think that the poorest of the poor are the least likely to have a moral hazard. They're basically borrowing money to eat food tonight. So I think that we should, you know, think about where the moral hazard is. You know, for instance, some lawyers that run away to Australia after they steal all of our money from our road accident fund, there's a huge moral hazard from a particular group, a race group in our country, and I think that we should, you know, bear that in mind. So this moral hazard, what I'm saying is, I don't believe that there will be a moral hazard that will result from this legislation because of the people that this legislation is aimed at. Thank you.
But we are also learning as we go along, and I welcome the professor's, you know, intervention there, pointing out to us that there is already established in law and practice these guidelines are already there, and we don't want to have to duplicate them in any way. But I mean, the reality is here, and we are trying to build a non-racial society, but it is regrettable that in doing so we have to address the past. We have no choice about that. And invariably the past includes one racial group, which is the majority mainly. But there was a time in our country as well when the Afrikaner found him or herself also very, very impoverished. And all of us are fully aware in our school days, if you are over 70, of all the learners, Afrikaans learners, whose parents could not afford to give them shoes to go to school with. So these things change, but with the Land Act of 1913, this changed things considerably with respect to the economy. And I think that is unfortunately a reality in our country that we have to address. We are not directly addressing that at the moment. We are addressing a particular target group, which is across the board. It is defined by the amount and the circumstance rather than the race per se. And I would hope that all of us do keep that in mind. But it does say to us, and I was in finance long before I came to trade and industry, and I found it quite remarkable how many times in the last 23, 24 years, those who have not paid tax, who are in a certain bracket, as it were, simply have carrots dangled in front of them. And I do fully understand why, because we do need to recover some of the funds. And you are encouraged and try and persuaded, if you pay now, we'll write off X. And I think we all understand that. It's been pragmatic to get certain monies back. But it is regrettable that that same opportunity has not as regularly, and I'm phrasing this quite deliberately in that way, I've not said never, I said as regularly been offered to the lower income and specifically the very poor, the poorest of the poor. And that is what this piece of legislation, proposed legislation, is attempting to do. But at the same time, as the Honourable Williams told us repeatedly months ago, we do want to also encourage responsible borrowing and not only hammer and discourage irresponsible and reckless lending. So it's a balanced approach to the matter. We also want to try to, and I think within the Act we were told at one stage, it is very difficult for the police to arrest the Mashonisiwa because there's no legislation specifically addressing that. And the reason and way that they address this is purely because such illegal lenders retain people's ID cards, and that is the way they get arrested, because there is no legislation against them. And that, you know, one should be mindful of as we move forward. I really think it is important, because we've seen the damage that is done in our country. Truly we do. And I would like to see all members of the committee from all parties working together to try and produce a responsible and robust piece of legislation. Because we don't want this to last for the life of just 3 or 4 years, but at least as it survives to become the platform and the pilot of what else can be built upon. That truly, to me, is critical. And before we close the meeting, we still have the program, but I do want to thank the advocate, the DDG, the chief executive officer and her team from the National Credit Regulator, Professor Maseko, and others, and yourself, Ms. Naidu, for being here the whole afternoon. And I want to encourage you to continue the journey, other stakeholders, with us. I would like to draw members' attention to the program, which is now going to be handed out, the revised program. And I want to thank members for applying their minds. This is a very difficult piece of legislation that we are looking at. Thank you. So yourself, Mr. Have we all got a copy? This is the program. Now, there is only one issue I would like to address with you as you look at the program. On Tuesday the 14th of August, given that members are returning from an incredibly busy weekend, we are starting the committee at 11 a.m. But I also became aware of, honourable members, the challenges in the Eastern Cape with flights. In fact, when I went down there for Township Economy, the seminar, I had to catch half a dozen flights just to get back to Johannesburg. So it isn't that simple to get to Parliament from the Eastern Cape on a busy day. And Tuesday is incredibly busy to get back directly to Cape Town. So we are starting the committee at 11 on that Tuesday the 14th. You will see there, as I said earlier on this morning, Honourable McPherson, that we have factored in the South African Bureau of Standards. Do you see that there on the 28th of August? ITAC should also have been factored in, and I'm just asking for the Mr. Hermans to draw my attention to when it is. Now, I'm asking him because I can't see it. ITAC. All right. It is on the same day. On the 28th of August, ITAC will also be here. All right? Are we all in agreement, Honourable Buyani?
Chairperson, there is one. I think the 28th is also a Tuesday. Can you agree that on Tuesday, the committee meeting starts at 11? Because the very same challenge that you raised now on this matter, it will also appear on that data. So that's my proposal, Chair. Thank you.
The Honourable Buyani, I could do that with the first one. We return to the normal schedule of Parliament then. And therefore, I'm governed by a superior program. So I can't alter the 28th, regrettably. It has to be at 9, unfortunately. So unless there are any serious queries, both from the DTI and the advocate in this regard, or the CEO, the National Credit Regulator. Have you all got this program? Yes. I hope you are able to comply with it. And I do want to thank members of the DA and the ANC for being here during the whole process, but also for being walking with us on this journey. And I want you to take the spirit of today forward, the prevailing spirit, the larger spirit you exhibited, what the whip referred to as the Mandela spirit. Do you know what he did say? People were surprised with whom he was negotiating at one point, and he said, you don't have to negotiate with friends. You negotiate with those who have a different opinion. He used a stronger word. And on that note, may I wish you all well. And when Women's Day comes up, which is shortly, even the men in this committee have a direct association with women, their mothers, and their wives in many cases, and sisters. I ask you to use this day to map out a year ahead in which you will commit yourself to some serious action to contribute to increasing the respect that women should enjoy and reducing the level of violence. I thank you. Meeting adjourned.